than the N-word. The R-word is no different than the N-word. Little red Sambo has to go. Little black Sambo is gone, and now it's time for little red Sambo to go. It has a tremendous psychological effect on Indian people.
That's Clyde Bellancourt, co-founder and director of the American Indian Movement, talking about the Redskins' name on Democracy Now! In November last year. Today, the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office has canceled the Washington Redskins trademark. The Patent Office called the NFL team's name, quote, disparaging to Native Americans. But in an Associated Press poll last year, 79% of respondents said the team should keep its name. And the team's owner, Dan Snyder, in an interview with USA Today, said, "We'll never change the name. It's that simple. Never. You can use caps." The journalist he talked to was sports reporter Eric Brady with USA Today, and he joins us now. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Barbara.
So let's start with this decision by the U.S. Patent Office. It's the result of a lawsuit brought on behalf of some Native Americans. What does it mean for Dan Snyder and the team?
Well, there's two tracks here. There's the legal track, and the team has said it will appeal. And in an earlier iteration of this case, it won on appeal, but that took 4 years. And I'm not sure they have 4 years this time, because last time it barely made a blip on the national radar, and this time it is big national news. There's a great deal of public pressure from the 50 senators, the national TV ads, and from groups like the National Congress of American Indians. And so the next thing to look for is to whether a sponsor might pull out. And if that were to happen, what happens on the legal track isn't going to matter as much.
And do you think the debacle over the Clippers owner Donald Sterling and his racist remarks is also playing into this, putting pressure on Dan Snyder?
Well, it is from this standpoint. The 50 senators who sent the letter to Commissioner Goodell made specific reference to the NBA reacting in the Sterling case in a short period of time, and how the NFL has not reacted over a long period of time. We should point out that the NFL pays the attorneys for the Washington team. The way it works is the league pays for all trademark litigation. So although the attorneys represent the team, they're being paid by the league, and that puts the commissioner in a bind.
Now, the Redskins owner, though, has said the name isn't just a label, that it's a badge of honor for the team. And he also implied that there's a long history of honor in this name among Native Americans. So are there, in fact, Native Americans that feel the name is some kind of badge of honor and support the team keeping it?
There are some. In the trademark case, all that had to be proved was that there was a, quote, substantial composite of Native Americans who found the name disparaging, not just now, but during the time that the marks were granted between 1967 and 1990. So that was a real trick in this case to try to, you'd need a time machine to know for sure, but the trademark board has turned down the football team on new registrations, about a half dozen times since 1992. So it was already established that the name is disparaging now, according to the trademark board. The question that was decided today is that it was disparaging to a significant composite then.
Well, Redskins, they're not the only pro sports team with a nickname related to Native Americans. You've got the Atlanta Braves and the Cleveland Indians and the Chicago Blackhawks and the Kansas City Chiefs. Those teams don't seem to be getting the same level of scrutiny as the Redskins. Why is that?
Well, the other names used in another context, the name Indians or Braves used in another context, is okay. The Indian groups will tell you that the term Redskin is always an epithet, a racial slur, unless applied to potatoes. But the other teams will begin to come under attack as well, I believe. And the Cleveland Indians, with its, quote, Chief Wahoo mascot, has already been under significant attack, because if you've ever looked at it, it's a big-toothed, big-nosed, red-faced caricature.
Well, part of the problem for the Redskins has to do with the history of the team and former owner George Preston Marshall, right? He gave the team the Redskins name, and he also refused to integrate the team. He kept it all white until 1960. What finally forced him to change his mind, and how does that history play into this?
Well, it's very interesting. It was the Kennedy administration which forced his hand. He needed to play games in a new stadium in which there had been some federal funding, and the Department of Interior put pressure on him to integrate the team, and he was the last owner in the National Football League to do that. He is known as a segregationist, and he even said in his will that no money could go to any organizations that were in favor of integration.
Well, has the Redskins responded to the Patent Office decision?
Well, their attorney responded, and they have said that they will appeal the decision. This is the second time the board has canceled these marks, and the first time the appeals court ruled in the team's favor. Now, that had to do on technical grounds, largely of the age of the petitioners. This time, they are younger petitioners, and presumably that defense can't be used this time. However, the decision today was a split decision, and the dissenters said, as was also said by one of the appeals court in the first case, that the ruling isn't backed by substantial evidence. So that will be the narrow legal ground that this case will be decided on as this goes forward.
Well, with this decision going to appeal, does that mean that people can print up T-shirts and sell them with the Redskins logo on it?
Well, not yet. Until the appeal is decided, they still retain their federal trademark protection, and the marks are not listed as canceled at this point. And even if they were to lose on appeal, the team can continue to attempt to enforce its trademark rights through common law and state statutes. However, one thing that you get from your federal trademark rights is registration with U.S. Customs, which prevents counterfeiters from bringing things in from overseas, and that's a right that they would lose.
Oh, I see. So if they lose the appeal, Dan Snyder still has a leg to stand on. This isn't the end.
No, and of course, he's got the right to call his team whatever he wants to. He can't be forced by the government to change his name. However, the government will not afford him federal trademark rights if it's deemed that the name is disparaging.
Eric Brady, he's a sports reporter for USA Today. Great to have you on the show.
Thanks, Barbara.
Well, what do you think? A good move by the Patent Office? Or should the government mind its own business? Give us a call and leave a voicemail at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY. Or you can join the conversation on Facebook and we might talk about you later. In other news out of Washington, General Motors Chief Executive Mary Barra appeared before Congress for a second time this morning to address what she calls a deeply troubling report about issues at GM. Lawmakers pressed Barra to explain GM's culture of secrecy and tried to understand why top executives didn't know about faulty ignition switches that claimed at least 13 lives. David Shepherdson attended the hearing this morning. He's Washington Bureau Chief for the Detroit News. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Barbara.
So this was the second time Mary Barra appeared in front of a House subcommittee. What did she say this time around?
You know, she said a lot of what she said the first time, that GM had serious culture problems, but she tried to get the message across that this is no ordinary business crisis, that she doesn't want the company to ever move on. She wants the company to never forget what a utter failure this was, because over a 10-year period, the company repeatedly opted not to recall these millions of vehicles and instead, you know, referred the issue to endless committees and spent years, you know, trying to ascertain the root cause rather than anybody stepping up and saying, this is a serious problem and we have to address it.
Well, and in her first round of appearances before Congress, she mostly took a look into that approach, what happened there. But this was an entirely different tone, right?
That's right, because remember when she first testified in early April, GM had hired Anton Valukas, the former U.S. attorney from Chicago, to conduct this internal review, which was ongoing. And in late May, the results of that review became public. She fired 15 employees, disciplined five. The Valukas report found a pattern of incompetence and neglect led to this problem. And in fact, Mr. Valukas was at the hearing as well, answering questions alongside Mary Barra.
And who else testified?
Oh, just the two of them, just the attorney and Mary Barra, although the committee does plan to call federal auto safety officials down the road.
Well, you were mentioning this Veluca's report. It went on for 315 pages, goes into graphic detail. Does that mean we now know who knew what and when?
We know who knew what and when, or we have a fairly good picture based on this really amazing review of 41 million pages, and they went to enormous lengths to uncover documents from, you know, computers and, you know, warehouses where GM keeps millions of pages of corporate records, and, you know, they interviewed over 200 employees, both current and former, and we know, you know, what happened in sort of excruciating detail about, you know, when the key mistakes were made, how they didn't put together the problem. And the main problem they couldn't figure out was that when these older Cobalt and other cars had this ignition switch problem, the key moved out of the run position to either the accessory or off mode, that the car stalled, and then often drivers lost control. But what they couldn't figure out for 10 years was that that also led to the airbag turning off and not deploying. So they just couldn't figure that out. And the report lays out how if they had worked, you know, together more closely, they could have figured this out far more soon. What it doesn't answer is the why. Why did certain employees not disclose more information? Why was there a culture where they didn't share bad news up the chain? And how did this corporate culture, how was it allowed to fester for so long?
And the why is instrumental to the house cleaning, too, right? I mean, we've had this report, there have been firings of key officials, but there's still more cleaning up to do. And yesterday, there was another GM recall of 3.5 million more cars. This is, what, the 44 recalls so far this year? Are all of them addressing these same safety issues? I mean, what's left that works in GM cars?
So Monday, there were actually 6 separate recall campaigns. There have been 3 major recalls for ignition switch problems. So Monday, you're right, there were about 3.5 million cars for a different ignition switch problem involving Impalas and cars dating back to 2000. They recalled 500,000 Camaros on Friday for ignitions. But the vast majority of cars, the 20 million vehicles worldwide they have recalled, are for many, many different reasons, you know, most of them totally unrelated to airbags or ignition switches, but it's part of this house cleaning GM is doing, going through every old possible safety issue and deciding to recall anything that it thinks might be a safety problem because, you know, as some emails have shown, the company was criticized by the government for not taking all auto safety issues seriously enough and for delaying or dragging its feet. And now the company has completely reversed course and is recalling, you know, everything it conceivably can and is not done yet. And Mary Barra said today you should expect more recalls between now and the end of the month.
Well, right. Or a more cynical person would say they're just trying to avoid yet another lawsuit. And as you said, a piece said in your paper, lawsuits against GM are stacking up like parts on the factory floor. And the most recent is possibly a multi-billion dollar class action suit brought by GM car and truck owners today. So what are they claiming?
So the main lawsuits which are out there, and the one today is for $10 billion involving, purporting to include everybody, all those 20 million people who have had their vehicles recalled. The main argument in these lawsuits is economic loss, that GM owners have suffered a decline in the value of their cars and trucks because of these recalls and the bad publicity and the fact that the company was not upfront about its problems, and as a result, when they go to trade those cars in or sell them, that the resale value has been diminished. And that's an argument that, you know, they may have some success with in the case of Toyota back in 2010, which went through a similar recall crisis over sudden acceleration problems. They ultimately settled the direct economic loss claims by individual owners for $250 million. Now, that was just a drop in the bucket, I think averaging $100 to $300 per vehicle, depending on which one. So, and there are still other hurdles that these GM owners have to face, because remember, before 2009, when the federal government bailed GM out, it was a different company. And so when GM exited bankruptcy in 2009, it emerged as an entirely new company, leaving behind the bad assets or the liabilities with the old company. So there's a big dispute over whether these old owners, in fact, will be able to actually have their lawsuits heard, or whether the bankruptcy liability shield from GM will prevent those from going forward.
Well, what's the possibility that any criminal prosecutions will come out of the investigations that are ongoing?
I think it's a very real possibility. Again, with Toyota, in March, the Justice Department, led by the U.S. Attorney's Office in New York, imposed a $1.2 billion fine on Toyota, forced the company to plead guilty to wire fraud. Now, granted, no individual Toyota executives were charged criminally, but this time it's different. You know, there's been a lot of criticism of the Justice Department for failing to hold individuals accountable. And, you know, consumer critics like Ralph Nader say a company can't commit a crime. People within the company have to actually go out and commit criminal acts. So there is a lot of I think public pressure to hold GM officials accountable. You have 13 people who died because of this defect and 50 crashes. So it's going to be a tough case, but you have a lot of people investigating, the SEC, a dozen attorney generals across the country. But, you know, like any prosecution, it's hard to, unless you can prove intent, and so far there's no evidence that, you know, but people were purposefully evading or hiding things, you know, for a specific motive, that's going to be the biggest hurdle. Can you prove people wantonly did this?
David Shepherdson is Washington Bureau Chief for the Detroit News. Thanks for taking the time.
Oh, thanks, Barbara.
Coming up, just 2 weeks left to fix America. What's on the Supreme Court's docket before its recess? That's just ahead on Press Play.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. You can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
This is Press Play. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Madeline Brand. The Supreme Court is in the last 2 weeks of its annual term, and it's expected to hand down some big decisions in the coming days. Some of the thorniest, most important cases of the term often get jammed into these final days of June. Cases touching on free speech, religious freedom, and union rights are all on the table. Dahlia Lithwick writes about the courts and law for Slate, and she's here to give us a primer on the most significant cases we'll be hearing about in the next couple of weeks. And welcome back to the show, Dahlia.
Thank you for having me.
Let's jump right in. One case that's gotten a lot of attention that's on the Supreme Court's list is the so-called Hobby Lobby case. Remind us what this concerns.
Right. That's probably the one that everybody is going crazy about, because I think it sweeps in, you know, these big questions about religious freedom and Obamacare and abortion. You know, it's kind of got everything. And really, it's a case that stems out of the Affordable Care Act. There is a contraception mandate in there where the government says, as part of the package of basic preventive care, employees now get contraception. And that was, at the time, seen as not that controversial. It has become very controversial for religious employers, in this case specifically the Green family, who owns the chain of Hobby Lobby stores. And they say, look, we are an evangelical Christian family. We fundamentally believe that certain types of contraception cause abortions. And if we supply those to our employees, we are causing abortions. So they're raising religious conscience objections, but not as individuals. They're saying the company itself has a kind of religious conscience. And this is a challenge brought under RFRA, the Religious Freedom Reformation Act, which really affords great protection to religious conscience objectors. So the case really is a collision between, on the one hand, you know, the rights of employees who now have a statutory right to get contraception, in some cases IUDs and things that are very, very costly, and their employers who say, our religion precludes us from giving that to you. It would be a violation of our religious faith. And kind of around the margins of this case, really deep questions about whether corporations are people with religions and how the court is going to deal with that. So it's kind of a big, big one.
Right. It's a real spider's web. Well, the word is that the court is likely to side with the business owners. And this court has tended to side with corporations over individuals or workers' rights. However, you point out that these things are all enmeshed in this case. So is that the way it's likely to go this time? And what would the implications of that be?
Well, you know, the big money is that it's going to be another one of those 5-4 decisions, you know, with Justice Kennedy, Anthony Kennedy, who's at the center of so many of these 5-4 decisions, siding with the conservative bloc. There is a possibility that they could go big or go small with this. In other words, they can have a huge big holding that will pretty much say, you know, every corporation can assert religious freedom rights and, you know, it'll be a free-for-all. And certainly I think there is a real fear on the part of, you know, minority groups, civil liberty groups, women's groups, that if that happens, you know, every single civil rights entitlement we have is at the mercy of our employers.
Well, another interesting one with its origins here in this state, Riley versus California, and this one is about whether police can search suspects' smartphones after they're arrested or if that's a Fourth Amendment violation. What's the likelihood the justices will make a selective ruling on this along the lines of it's okay to search the phone if the case involves a murder but not for, say, a DUI?
Right. That was certainly where the justices were heading at oral argument. They seemed very aware of the fact that on the one hand, you know, to suggest, it's just a phone and you can search it without a warrant, that can't be right because your cell phone today is the equivalent of your desk, right? It's got all of your papers.
It's your
journal,
whole world,
your whole
life.
World. And I think the court was certainly cognizant, you know, to allow the police to root through your phone is not the same as allowing them, you know, to look in your glove box, for instance. But this is another one of those interesting cases, Barbara, where, you know, the court is trying to apply these Fourth Amendment doctrines that, you know, the framers was clear in their heads what was in your pockets and what was in your desk. Modern technology confounds that so much, and the courts having to apply those old doctrines to new technology is always challenging.
Right, and you can see them trying to wring their minds around how they should do that. But in a case that could potentially change a very high-tech industry, the cable industry, there's ABC versus Aereo, and this is about copyright. Aereo is a New York tech company that streams local TV signals on the internet and using tiny remote antennas, and they're not paying licensing fees for this content. And broadcasters say that that violates the Copyright Act. So how likely is it the court will favor Aereo in this case? Because that could be a big shakeup for cable providers.
Yeah, the court didn't seem at oral argument too sympathetic to Aereo. There was a sort of theme of, wait, you're just stealing, at least at some part of oral argument. But the court seemed very aware, you know, having said that sometimes the justices struggle to understand modern technology. They were very aware of the implications of this case for anything that has to do with cloud computing. You know, like this has a huge implication for Dropbox and any other technology that stores information in the cloud. So I think the court was struggling a lot with some kind of just gut sense that what Aereo was doing by selling people these teeny little cables and letting them, in effect, steal broadcast television at no cost, that you know, does have serious copyright implications. It does harm the networks profoundly. But at the same time, to completely shut it down will have massive implications for new technology. So the court is, again, really struggling to balance very, very strong competing interests on both sides.
Well, there's more than a dozen unresolved cases, at least, and at least 6 really big ones, and just not so many days. What do you think the timing is going to look like for the court?
Well, I think we're pretty sure there's definitely going to be decisions this Thursday, then next Monday, and then we'll see what happens. But the justices really try very hard to wind up this year by June 30th, by the end of June, because they all have obligations out in the world in July. And generally what we see is that the big, big biggies come down at the very end.
Why? Why does that always happen, that they cram so many heavyweight decisions into these last 2 weeks?
You know, my flip answer is that any institution where where the justices pop out from behind a big red velvet curtain before every performance tells you that the value of theater must matter a little bit to them. But I think the truth is those are often the really, really hard ones that are getting drafted and redrafted and amended and circulated. And these are the ones, you know, that they're the hard cases for a reason, and I think they're hard for the justices too. But as a reporter who then, you know, has a week of no eating and no showering because they all come down in the same 2-3 days, I could wish otherwise.
And everyone's wondering, when will Ruth Bader Ginsburg retire?
Right. She's 81. She has had not one, but two brushes with cancer. And there is a very, very vocal lobby in the left, particularly the academic left, saying, oh, my God, step down now while Obama can replace you, because, you know, the whole court in a deep way will shift if she's replaced by a Republican. Ginsburg has made it absolutely clear, A, that she doesn't want to go anywhere, and B, that these pleas kind of irk her. So I think Ginsburg and Ginsburg insiders are pretty confident that this is not the year she steps down, and that, you know, you can push her all you want and say that liberals are not savvy about who replaces them at the court, but she seems unbothered by the criticism.
Dahlia Lithwick writes about the courts and law for Slate. I appreciate it. Thank you so much for this.
Thank you so much for having me.
Just ahead, no, honey, I'm not drunk. I'm just oxidizing, breaking up, and converting ethanol to a more usable form. Proof, The Science of Booze. It's a new book, and it's coming at you after the news with Eric Roy.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
This is Press Play. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Madeline Brand. And I know it's only just midday, but it's time to do some shots. Bottoms up. Prost. And as you experience that singular burn in the back of your throat, why not consider the science behind the burn? Why does alcohol affect us the way it does? Or even better, how did alcohol enter into our collective lives in the first place? Well, Adam Rogers has been asking these questions for years now, with a glass almost always in his hand, it seems. And the product of his investigation is out. It's a book called Proof, The Science of Booze. Adam, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. I would like to say, though, just to be clear, I found it next to impossible to actually write while I was drinking.
Well, I'm suppose good. We're all relieved to hear that. Now, before I did read your book, though, I always assumed that every culture and every civilization has found a way to get drunk. But you phrase it differently. You say that developing liquor seems to be part of growing up as a people. How is that and why is that?
Well, I do think that. I do think that figuring out how to not invent but tame this process, this natural process that yeast use, that converting sugar into ethanol and carbon dioxide, fermentation, right, was the thing that made us, that changed us from Homo sapiens to people. It happened when we became civilized. And it happened about 9 or 10,000 years ago. The oldest evidence of human-controlled fermentation is from a shard of pottery from China, a site called Jiahu. It's a really interesting site. It's actually one of the places with the oldest musical instruments and the oldest written language as well. And
well, that makes evidence, the case right there. Civilization.
That's right.
Music,
that's where
literature,
you have
booze.
That's right. And of course, you know, archaeologists and anthropologists argue about whether we started planting grain crops in rows to make bread or brew beer. You know, what was the goal? And you can imagine which side of that argument I fall on.
Well, I have so many questions about the early days, but it always stumps me. Why do humans eat rotten stuff?
Right. This is the fermentation writ large, right? So fermentation is transformation, right? And understanding what was behind those transformations is what gave rise to modern biochemistry and to some extent modern cell biology as well. Figuring out that the fermentation that we understood that took sugar and turned it into ethanol was related to but different than the fermentation that gave us acetic acid, right, vinegar, or that gives us lactic acid that we use for pickling. And in fact, for a while, people thought that all those transformations were related to decomposition. when a dead thing starts to break down and fall apart, because things were changing and people didn't know why. And it was an attempt to understand why those things were changing that carries us through a lot of the origins of modern science.
Well, you write that when someone named Theodor Schwann finally did figure out the science of the yeast, the magical alcohol creatures, that it's actually not making live things dead, but living things more alive, right? Alcohol?
It's true in a way. And Schwann was roundly ridiculed.
Yeah, right. Chemists laughed at him. Why?
Yeah. Well, part of that is because chemists always laugh at biologists, because that rivalry is, you know, the sharks and jets from days gone by. Montagues and Capulets, I suppose, more accurate. Because each one of those groups thinks that they're studying something more fundamental than the other. It's just, it's a thing that science has. Don't even get the physicists started on who's actually right. But the chemists didn't think that you needed a biological agent. They didn't think you had to have life to make something happen. And Schwann was suggesting something that was pretty revolutionary. Nobody had come right out and said, listen, we see these little things in a microscope every time we're doing fermentation. I think they're the responsible agents. And he didn't know why. In fact, the person who really sort of figured it out and did the proof for it was a young researcher at the time. Everybody was doing fermentation and making billions of the equivalent of billions of dollars at the time, and nobody knew what to do when it didn't work. And so when it wasn't working in this alcohol factory, this young researcher named Louis Pasteur came in. Hadn't done germs yet. He was just starting out his career, and what he figured out is when you had the fermentation, then it worked, then all I see in the microscope is yeast. But when you have a fermentation that's not working, I see yeast, and I see these black things. I don't know what they are. They turned out to be lactic acid bacteria, spoiled milk or pickles. And he said, I don't know how to fix it, but clean out the tanks that it's not working. Make sure you're just using yeast. And the argument went on for decades even after that. But he started writing books about beer, about wine. It was the beginning of his career, understanding that you had to have yeast involved, that a living thing was doing chemistry. It was the beginning of the field of biochemistry.
Let's go to the dark side now. In scientific terms, does alcohol make people violent? Or is there a scientific explanation for why some people get violent when they drink?
That's a really good pair of questions, because the first question is super easy. Yes, violence is one of the few things that researchers have, with some reliability, associated with ethanol as a recreational drug that's not actually associated with almost any other recreational drug. We think of the drug business being very violent, and it is, because it's an illicit market with a lot of money at stake. But the drugs themselves, the violence isn't necessarily associated with these other drugs in the way that it is with ethanol. But then you asked, well, why does it do that? And that becomes a question that becomes super hard to answer.
Well, what have scientists looked at in terms of the relationship between violence and alcohol?
Well, in the 1960s, there was a book with the wonderful title Drunken Comportment that was an ethnological study that attempted to bring together all the different research that field researchers had done on the different cultures that use alcohol and the different rituals around it and what the effects were. And the book walks right up to the line of arguing that ethanol has, in fact, no intrinsic effects. They found cultures where, oh, all the men get together and they drink all afternoon and they get violent. But when the men and the women get together for an evening time party, it's very social and really pleasant. But then there's this other culture over here where when the men drink together, it's a completely, like, gridded ritual behavior that only goes a certain way and never gets violent and is very religious. But when they drink with the women, oh, it's violent and people get hurt and there's always a fight. And the idea that they were trying to get across was many cultures consume alcohol, and those that do have wildly varying effects.
We're talking to Adam Rogers. His new book is Proof, The Science of Booze. And we have been talking about the science of booze, but I think we really have to get to the aftermath, the hangover. What is a hangover?
Oh, man. You know, I think everybody who's had one knows how they would describe theirs, but it has been brutal for researchers to try to figure out a common description, come up with a common set of symptoms, and then figure out what they are. So everything that they told you that first day before your first night of college turns out to be not true, or at least not proven. The dehydration thing, alcohol dehydrates you, but dehydration is not what causes a hangover. The thing about mixing booze, not true. Sugary booze, not true.
Wow. So I'm not supposed to drink five glasses of water before I go to bed with two ibuprofen?
Well, I mean, okay. See what you just did there. the water's not going to hurt you, right? And there is some dehydration, and it's nice to deal with that. But hydrating is not going to get rid of your hangover. But what researchers do seem to be circling around is the idea that hangovers are an inflammatory response. why that happens is not totally clear, although there is inflammatory response in the liver as the liver tries to process ethanol. So maybe it's related to that. I'm speculating out of turn. But, you know, you can do studies where you can induce hangover-like symptoms by administering chemicals that the immune system uses. That's an inflammatory response. Similarly, you can see heightened immune molecules, immune substances in the bloodstream when people are hungover. So that makes it seem like a pretty good candidate. And in one study of a drug called Clotam, which is a really very powerful anti-inflammatory prescribed for migraines, that did seem to have a pretty good effect on dealing with the symptoms of hangover. Clotam is also not in the U.S. pharmacopoeia. You can't get it here. I tried.
I bet you did while you were writing this book. Well, so more hangover myth busting. I always follow the drink clean rule. The clearer the drink, the less likely it'll give you a headache. Is that a myth?
You know, I hate to do this myth busting on hangovers because I don't want to mess up anybody's placebo. And if you've got a good placebo, I hate to talk you off it, man. I'd feel bad about that. But yeah,
I think I know where you're going, though.
So yes, where that idea comes from is the idea that it's the congeners, it's the other things in the drink, the not ethanol and not water, are the things that give you a hangover. So if you just stick to vodka, right, you're golden. But the fact is, people, you know, drink vodka and you still get hungover. So there's something else going on there. There have been some studies that reported that people get worse hangovers with the brown spirits, with things like brandy and bourbon. But the studies were small and you're still hungover with the vodka. So clearly that's not the mechanism.
Well, one more. Is hair of the dog a thing?
Hair of the dog is fascinating because there used to be a whole category of morning drinks, right, of pick-me-ups, they were called, that were designed to be consumed the morning after.
Well, there still are, right?
Well, so you have the Bloody family, right? The mm-hmm. Bloody Maria, Bloody Mary, and a mimosa, right? Are these brunch drinks. My favorite is actually the Corpse Reviver number 2, which if you don't know, seems like, oh, it's a zombie drink, right? But actually the corpse in the name is you, you know, is the drinker. It's like you're shambling to the bar in the morning before you go to work to get one of these things. It's a delicious cocktail, actually. But there's a story you could tell yourself about why this might work, which is that maybe hangovers are related to methanol. So, you know, methanol is the thing that, like, oh, if you get bad moonshine, it's the thing that makes you go blind. It has a really interesting mechanism. It gets broken down by the same enzyme that would ordinarily deal with ethanol. When you give that enzyme methanol, it turns to formaldehyde and then formic acid, which messes up the body's ability to process oxygen, to metabolize oxygen, which is why the eyes are the thing that goes first, because the eyes use a lot of oxygen. And the way you treat methanol toxicity, like if somebody shows up in the emergency room super toxic with methanol, they give them a big dose of ethanol because it displaces that methanol off the enzyme. So you end up excreting it through your breath and through your pee instead of converting it into the molecules into the chemicals that do so much damage. And the idea is like, well, maybe a hangover is like light methanol toxicity. And if you have hair of the dog, then that's going to displaces the methanol and then you're not going to have the symptoms of that. I don't trust that story. I love the story of methanol toxicity, but there's so little methanol in what you're drinking, especially in distilled spirits. Maybe there's a little bit more, but if there's methanol in it, you're drinking something poisonous, you know.
Well, you were so skeptical about so much of what you read and heard about that you got a bunch of these hangover remedies that showed promise together, right? And you invited friends over to try them out. Hard work. Somebody has to.
This was a terrible, terrible idea. So there have been studies that looked at some over-the-counter compounds that did have an effect on hangover symptoms. So I got a bunch of them and we tried them. We drank a lot of things and we got a breathalyzer because I just wanted to make sure all of us got to point one, which is the point after which you're going to be hungover. Yeah, uh-huh. But then the breathalyzer didn't work. So it seemed like it would make a lot of sense to just make sure that we would have hangovers, and we made too sure. We didn't really see enough of an effect.
I can see why you're a journalist and not a scientist.
Well, you know, the study design was flawed. Yes, it was not a scientific study. The N was too small. There were only 3 of us, and there was no control group, and we overdid it.
So no conclusion?
Pure anecdote. I wouldn't trust it.
Okay, very good. Fair enough.
None of them seemed to help, but that is pure anecdote. And also, I would say, too, don't take advice from me on how to do this stuff. I mean, I'm just a journalist. Like, taking medical advice from me would not be smart.
And just briefly, have scientists come up with any kind of alternative to ethanol completely? You know, something that has a similar effect as alcohol, but wouldn't impair our ability to drive, wouldn't make people violent, wouldn't be addictive, and would not cause a hangover? And also would give you eternal youth and a unicorn.
Exactly. And also make you happy at work. I guess ethanol already does that a little bit, but well, you're asking for synthahol. You want a Star Trek drink. And so do a lot of people. There is a researcher in England. He's a famous drug and alcohol researcher, actually. And he has said in a few places in his writing that he has a set of candidate chemicals. They're benzodiazepine analogs. They're in the family of drugs like Valium, but not Valium, that make you feel exactly as if you've had a drink or two. Now, you still wouldn't be able to, like, drive or anything while you were under their influence, but the critical thing there is that he has antidotes. So you can take another pill, and the effects are gone.
Wow, slippery slope.
As if you didn't have it. He says there's still more research to be done. He's looking for research funding. He doesn't have it yet. He says he has them.
Adam Rogers' new book is called Proof, The Science of Booze, and I do hope we meet someday for a drink. That would be wonderful.
First round's on me.
Warren Olney is here, and I do hope we meet someday for a drink, but that's not why you're here.
First round will be on me. I'll take his line. We're going to be talking about the school decision here in Los Angeles last week against the teacher tenure rules and last hired, first fired rules that protect the
teachers. Which we talked about on this show.
We certainly did, and on this show and on our Which Way LA program as well. It's having a national influence. There's no question about a national impact, and the school reformers are picking it up, and they're thinking about moving into other states. It was a heavily financed legal case. And so we'll talk about what the impact might be and also about other kinds of approaches to the concern about poor teachers in schools with high minority and poor student populations.
Right, and that's the crux of it.
It
is. And that's coming up on To the Point with Warren Olney. But first on our show, scratch and sniff texting. Also, Facebook gives us more control with one hand while getting deeper into our business with the other. We'll have a tech roundup. That's next on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Los Angeles. We rely on listeners like you. Support the podcasts you love by becoming a member. Go to kcrw.com/join.
And this is Press Play. I'm Barbara Bogave sitting in for Madeline Brand. The future is here on Press Play. We're bringing it to you with Ariel Bogle. She's a researcher for Future Tense. That's a collaboration between Slate, the New America Foundation, and Arizona State. And she's here with the latest tech news, starting with breaking news from Silicon Valley. Welcome back, Ariel.
Hi, great to be here.
Breaking news. Just a bit ago, Amazon announced that it's getting into the smartphone business. And it sounds like the aha moment of the announcement is that their phone will have some kind of 3D capacities. What are they offering?
That's right. I mean, there's been rumors flying around for months now that Amazon was going to bring out a smartphone, and today they were proven correct. And it's true, I think, that of all the different features that Amazon proposed, the one that they're calling dynamic perspective is most interesting. It's going to involve four small infrared cameras on the front of the phone that can capture the sort of angle of your head, where you're looking at all times. So it can give you on the screen a kind of 3D sense of if you're looking at a map, say, you could see the Empire State Building in a 3D perspective, or if you're flipping through a book, you could kind of see layers of pages.
And it won't all be dark like 3D movies?
No glasses required for this one either.
Well, why does Amazon want in on the smartphone market at this point?
Well, it's interesting you should ask that. I think that it's just trying to get a foothold in the product space, because really at the moment Amazon is still just a merchant, a multi-million dollar merchant, of course, but still just a merchant. And they really want to get a platform that sort of facilitates the relationship between you and them, ostensibly so you can buy more things.
On your phone, right.
Well, exactly.
What kind of reaction are you seeing so far?
Well, it's varying. Some people, of course, very excited about the 3D prospect, but some people are saying it's just a gimmick and we'll have to see whether it's really useful and not just something cool to play with. But people are also kind of concerned and excited about another feature of the phone that they're calling Firefly. And this feature is so important that it's got its own dedicated button. And essentially what it is a button that if you press it, will look at any object, just say a book or a box of toothpaste, and it will show you immediately how to buy it on Amazon. It also can capture sounds or even a moving image. Say you're watching Game of Thrones and you want to buy the episode. It'll let you do that seamlessly.
So that's a Shazam feature, and also connects you directly to the lifeblood or the cashier,
right.
The cash register of Amazon.
Right.
Well, as far as we know, the Amazon phone won't have smell-o-text, though, will it? Which is what you reported on yesterday.
No, that's right. No smell-related features on the new Amazon Fire phone that I've heard.
What is smell-o-text? Need we explain it? Is it just scratch and sniff for your text? I say just as if that's not shocking.
No. Well, yeah. So yesterday, the first transatlantic smell mail was sent from Paris to New York to the Museum of Natural History, actually in Manhattan. And so this is a product of a company called Vapor Communications, led by a Harvard professor called David Edwards. And what it is, essentially, they've built this product that they're calling an O-phone. It's a cylinder that has these small microchips in the bottom, which can release scents for about 10 seconds. So you'll be able to take a photo of something, say Eggs Benedict at your brunch spot, at your local brunch spot, and you could tag that photo with the smell of Eggs Benedict, send it to a friend, and if they're near, for the moment, only one of the hot spots in Paris or New York, they'll be able to smell what you just smelt.
Oh, I really see this going very, very wrong. And right. Isn't some hacker just going to get into this thing right away and send us all stink bombs?
I know, that is the fear, I think. With the O-phone specifically, they told me that they're only going to work on food-related smells for now. So the O-chips, the little chips that are in the bottom of this gadget, can only release food smells. So we're not quite at the point of fart bombs or stink bombs.
We'll be there tomorrow.
I'm sure.
Let's be real.
Very soon.
Well, you probably shouldn't smell-o-text and drive, but we can work our navigation systems, at least in California, on our phones. Perhaps soon we won't be able to do that, though, depending on the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, right? They want to regulate our navigation apps. What do they want to do specifically?
That's right. So the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, which is a bit of a mouthful, want the sort of go ahead from Congress to be able to regulate apps that allow navigation, say Google Maps, Apple Maps, or Waze. They say that they have this authority already, but they're just seeking the explicit go ahead from Congress.
And
so they'll want to sort of restrict apps and make sure that they can order app developers to make changes in the name of safety.
Well, how should we feel about this? Because this is the same agency that at one point tried to make it illegal for us to change radio stations at the wheel, right? I mean, would rock and roll have even happened if we couldn't listen to the radio and drive in L.A.?
I know. I'm sure it's a big concern for people in L.A. You really want to be able to do a whole diverse range of things in your car. So it really depends. I think we can all say that texting and talking on the phone while driving can be kind of dangerous. So that's the same with looking and fiddling with Google Maps, just say you're trying to write an address into your Google Map app while driving and you keep spelling it wrong or something like that. That could really distract you and have some pretty bad consequences. But on the other hand, regulators like the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration have not had the best track record with keeping up with technology and regulating it in a smart way.
And now just briefly, the other big news was about the Facebook privacy policy change. So now we can personalize our personalized ads. Is that a good summary?
Yeah, more or less. Really, Facebook is going to give you a sort of glimpse into the dossier that they keep on you, which they give to advertisers so that they can target you with those specialized ads. Say you've indicated on Facebook you've liked a resort in Hawaii. They're going to show you ads for swimsuits or flights or things like that. So they're going to let you have a glimpse at these dossiers, even change them, add to them, delete information on there. Yeah.
But we can't get rid of the ads altogether.
No, I don't think they're ever going to allow you to do that. That's just not going to work with Facebook's business model. But say you deleted all your likes and deleted all that information, they're just going to serve you ads that have no relevance to you. So it really depends. Some people find ads useful.
Ariel Bogle, researcher for Future Tense, a collaboration between Slate, New America Foundation, and Arizona State University. And it was wonderful having you on our show. Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Jolie Myers, so nice to have you here.
I've got all the feedback and more today, Barbara, including hangover cures.
Let's wonderful.
Not bury the lead here in honor of our discussion with Adam Rogers about his new book, Proof. I asked you all for your homespun hangover cures. Barbara, first, any Bogave family remedies?
No, none whatsoever.
None. That's probably because there aren't really remedies.
We're not big drinkers.
Really?
Yeah, no.
Okay. I thought with the Ukrainian last name, I mean, maybe I'm working in stereotypes here.
I have a hollow leg, but I don't seem to get very bad hangovers.
Well, mine is a big old bag of McDonald's, Barbara. It works every time. I understand that my solution may not be popular with our listeners, but I'd rather be judged by you all than have a hangover.
So that's the grease.
It must be the grease. It's the double cheeseburger going two times. Jamie Nettles says on Facebook that she goes for a run when she's hungover. No matter how bad she feels or how little sleep she's gotten, a run always makes her feel better. I find that incredibly hard to believe. But
I'm really impressed by you. Right? And that's like dehydration upon dehydration.
Yeah, I can't understand it. And that's not what I'm going for. Unless I'm running to the McDonald's. okay, so now on to the controversial football team in Washington, D.C. They've had their trademark revoked. And you all had plenty to say on that topic. Chris Sawick on Facebook had this to say: if Native Americans say the team's name is offensive, maybe we should take their word for it. I love how white people think it's up to white people to decide if their racial slurs for other people should be tolerated by those people. So that's an interesting commentary from Chris Sawick.
One man's opinion.
One man's opinion. And Johnny Vargas says, great job, Patent Office. This totally makes up for all the land we took away from the Native Americans. So lots of cynicism today on our Facebook
zingers
page.
Zingers from our audience. And thank you.
Keep them coming.
Yeah, we enjoy them. And thank you, Jolie.
Of course, anytime.
If you have any other thoughts or zingers for us, we'd love to hear them. You can reach us old school at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY. We're also on Twitter at KCRW Press Play. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.